Today is Monday, December 26th, 2022. This is part one of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jeff St. John. And Jeff spells his last name capital S T period space J O H N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Jeff. How are you today?
Good, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. Jeff, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Thank you. Jeff, what year were you born?
I was born in 1965 in a small town in southwest Illinois.
What were your folks doing out there at the time?
That's where they both grew up, was in southwest Illinois, a small town called Edwardsville, about 25 miles northeast of St. Louis.
Okay. I think of green rolling country, lots of trees.
Yes. It's right on the edge of the prairie. So my mother grew up in a farming family, actually out on the prairie. And in the town where my dad grew up is just as you described, kind of a rolling, hilly, green countryside, forested.
Okay. And what'd your dad do?
My dad was a laborer in a laborer's union, and eventually through that became the superintendent of the water treatment plant for the city of Edwardsville.
Oh, wow. And did your folks, did they know each other in high school?
No, my dad was 5 years older than my mother.
Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have a younger sister. She's 5 years younger than me. Her name is Stacy St. John, and she has lived quite literally all over the world, but now she is back in the southwest Illinois area.
Wow, okay. What was growing up like for you? Did you get a chance to, you know, do the summer vacation in the station wagon thing, or
some of that. It was a small city, small town environment. Knew everybody, spent my whole life there. From all the different school levels through high school, knew just quite a lot of people my entire life. It seemed as if my mother knew every single person in my hometown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Couldn't get in too much trouble without her knowing about it.
Would you camp out in your summers, or would you spend time, you know, were there rivers nearby?
There are a number of rivers in South Missouri in the Ozark Mountains. So we'd go camping a bit down there, do a lot of the canoe float trips on those rivers. Yes, it would went camping quite often during the nicer weather. Sometimes in the not nicer weather.
Okay. And then growing up in school, small town, you would have known everybody. What was high school like?
So it was a very good school. We had the luxury of being not only our county capital, so we had all the county administration and court system people living there. We also had a university there, Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville campus. And because of that, we had a lot of professors and students that lived in the town. And then it was at that point in town, it was kind of a self-contained area. A lot of folks in agriculture, a lot of folks in various manufacturing and service industries. So it was a very nice town. And our school district was just huge. It encompassed a lot of smaller communities and rural areas. And so we had overall in our high school was about 1,800 students when I was going there.
Wow. That's big. I'm thinking, did you have any interests in junior high, high school? Were you on in sports or?
Besides, like, summer baseball,
Okay.
My main thing I did in back then was we had a Explorer Post/Junior Volunteer Fire Department at our fire department, and I was very involved in that for a number of years, and for a bit of time there, considered becoming a firefighter paramedic.
And why didn't you?
At a certain point in time, I started realizing that that while it's a great job, it doesn't pay a lot. And so I started looking into other fields where maybe I could make a little bit better living. And just through my family, we had a number of construction-related people in our family, carpenters and laborers. Realized that I kind of liked the civil engineering side of it and became interested in that. And eventually, when I went away to college, that's what I majored in.
Okay. When you were growing up, was there any mention? Was it expected from your parents that, you know, college was going to be a pathway for you?
No, not very much. In fact, I always found it humorous that I had already been applying to colleges. I had made up my mind to go relatively early in high school, but I remember sitting there in spring a couple months before I graduated, and my mom's like, you know, Jeff, your dad and I think you ought to go to college.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'm like, that's a good thing because I've been accepted at four and I'm on my way.
So. Was she surprised?
No, not at all. But it was, again, it was at that point in time, I had one uncle. She was from a family of 13 kids.
Okay.
And only one of her siblings went to college. Actually, I guess two did. And then I only had one cousin out of a number who was 1 year older than me that she went to college. So she was the first of the grandchildren on that side of the family to go to college.
Wow.
And on my dad's side, it wasn't the given either. It was a smaller family, but not a lot of history of at least 4 year colleges. It was a junior college.
Okay. Did your mom work when you were growing up? Did she help your dad?
She was a homemaker.
Okay.
She would hit me upside the head with something if I said she didn't work.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you and your little sister, and a huge job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then for college, by the time you were a senior, had you already kind of made up your mind that you were looking to kind of go into civil engineering?
Yes, I had made up my mind on that either right before or right when I started my junior year of college, high school.
Okay. Did you have any teachers that were kind of steering you in that direction, that were kind of fueling that fire?
No, not especially. I did do better in the science and math classes.
Okay.
So there was that. And I always participated in the more challenging of those classes that our school offered. Did okay in the other fields too, but my stronger subjects were the math and science courses.
Nice. Okay. And then you mentioned I missed that. Where did you end up deciding to go to college? Because there was a university right there in your hometown. So.
Right. So I couldn't go there. I mean, that's number one, right? I started out actually at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Wait. Alaska, what got you going to Alaska?
Well, if you want to go away to college, that's as far away as you could go to college.
I guess so. Had you been to Alaska?
Never. So that was just something that was very interesting to me, and so I started out up there. I didn't have enough money to keep going up there. So I was only there for my first year, and then I transferred to a Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, about 120 miles southeast of where I grew up.
So closer to home, but still far away.
Yeah.
You could visit on weekends if you wanted.
Yep, that was the possibility, and then it fit into my economic model, I guess you would say.
And how did you manage to get through college? Because Alaska, everything is pricey up there.
So it was a combination back then of at the time I thought they were big. Now I couldn't tell you that they were big, but the federal student loans.
Okay.
And working. I worked all but one semester I was in college. So.
And what did you do, especially up in Alaska? What was it? What did you do up there your first fall and spring?
I worked in the food service in one of the cafeterias.
Okay.
Really, our only cafeteria that we had for the dorms. And then I worked in there serving and sometimes cooking, sometimes washing dishes, whatever.
Okay.
So, and then when I went to Carbondale, I worked in a bar as a bouncer and later bartender and manager of the bar.
Okay.
And then during the summers, I worked as a surveyor at a local engineering and surveying firm in my hometown.
Moving brush, making lines, setting up foresights, backsights, did you start getting some exposure to the station, to the surveyor, and what exactly they were doing with their math?
Yeah. In fact, that was one of the funny things. Back then, we didn't have laptops or whatnot, and using what we called COGO, coordinate geometry, was still rather new. Basically figuring everything out almost as a computer would, but manually sometimes. And I used my boss, which he would have to call in information on our radio to our base office, and they would put something into the computer and spit an answer out to him. Well, while he was doing that, I would take some spare paper, and I would do this my trigonometric calculations on the back of the paper, and half the time I was getting the answer faster and correct. So that was kind of fun, and the folks there at the surveying firm enjoyed that. So I spent 2 years working as a rod man, and then during the summers, and then eventually had my own crew.
Wow, nice. And so that third year would have been your senior year in college. That's when you had your own crew?
Between my junior year and my first senior year, yes.
Okay. So, how did that work out?
Well, no, very common in engineering. 132 hours were required to get a bachelor's degree in engineering. And we always complained that there was a class that should have been worth more credit hours than you were given. And the standard answer was yes, but if it gave you that credit hour, then it's technically a 5-year degree.
Hmm.
So, and then with transfers and some elective classes that I took, I just needed 5 years to get through.
Okay. So not all your credits from Alaska carried over?
Most did, but some did not.
Okay. So, yeah. All right.
But it was also, there were some other interests, some subjects I wanted to take. One class I had to take twice.
Like what?
Structural analysis. Believe it or not.
Okay.
First time it just didn't sink in, and I decided that, wait a minute, if this is what I want to do for a living, maybe I ought to shoot for a better grade and understand it.
Hmm.
So second time I took it, it sank in.
Nice. Okay. Carbondale. I'm thinking there's a lot of coal mining going on around Carbondale.
There was. Yeah, Southern Illinois was a huge coal mining district up through the 1980s. But a combination of underground mining and strip mining.
Okay.
Of course, strip mining went out of fashion because of the environmental impacts.
Mm-hmm.
So that really phased out in the 80s. And the underground mining, unfortunately, Southern Illinois coal, they often will spout out the fact that there's enough coal there to power America for 100 years, it tends to be high sulfur coal.
Okay.
And requires quite a bit of treatment or, the scrubbing. power plants, so they'd like to use the cleaner burning coal from Wyoming in places, if they can. So,
okay.
It's always interesting to watch when you go on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. You'll see barge loads of coal being pushed downstream, and you'll see barge loads of coal being pushed upstream, and they'll sometimes pass each other on the river. And it's the high sulfur coals tend to be going to foreign countries.
Oh, wow.
And then they're moving the lower sulfur coal up the rivers to the various power plants. So anyway, Carbondale had a big history in that, but by the 80s, it was really starting to diminish. And then in the 90s, some of the last nails in the coffin for that.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about civil engineering. What types of engineering are incorporated in that arena?
Quite a few. So civil engineering can range everywhere from designing drainage systems for subdivisions and the grading of subdivisions, which the company I worked for did a lot of that back in the 80s and continue to it. Civil engineering can go up through various, quite a few environmental engineering practices. There tend to not be a lot of colleges that offer environmental engineering degrees, so a lot of people that are interested in that will get a civil degree with emphasis on that, on those courses. So you'll have that. You can get into a lot of planning, a lot of urban planners, a lot of city engineers, county engineers tend to have civil degrees. Same with DOT folks for road work and whatnot, airport projects, paving, runways, and everything. And then you can get into the structural side of it. And that I had gone into it for the structural side.
Was that a strength of the U of Illinois Carbondale?
No,
there a structural side? No.
No, the strength of Southern Illinois Carbondale is cheap. It was the cheapest engineering school in the state of Illinois.
Okay.
So that they actually, when I first started, did not even have a civil engineering degree. They had one that they called engineering mechanics and materials, which they kind of a broader degree. And then while I was there, and I knew this when before I started there, they split that program into both a mechanical engineering and a civil engineering curriculum. And so because of it, when I started out, I had classes that would apply to both.
Okay.
And if I had elected to go to school another semester, could have had his degree in mechanical engineering as well. But I was more interested in the civil side. I'd run out of money, so it's time to graduate.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. But you still got exposed to a lot of mechanical engineering.
Yes. Yeah. And many engineering programs have that. We probably had, as civil engineering students at that university, we probably had two or three more classes than what you would get at a traditional civil engineering curriculum at other universities.
And in your summers, you were working for an engineering company, it sounds like, during the survey work. So you would have seen what you were learning in practice on the ground.
Yes, yes. So got to do the construction surveying for a couple of projects, as well as doing your typical residential surveying and farm work type surveying. We also did some construction surveying, so I had some exposure to that.
Okay. And then as you were getting close to finishing college, where were you thinking of going? What were you thinking of doing?
Well, until about 5 months before, not even that long, 3 months before I graduated, I had anticipated going into the Army.
Okay.
And wanted to go into the combat engineers or another program. And so I applied to go into officer's candidate school.
Yep.
And had to take a number of exams for that and did not get it as a guaranteed appointment. I was each recruiting battalion was giving one slot for OCS, and I was not the one from our region. So they made me another offer, which was join up, and then you'll almost surely get selected. And with my dad and most of my uncles have been ex-Army, I took that exactly for what it was worth and decided not to join up as a private.
Okay.
And took my chances trying to find a job out in the market, and did.
Where was that?
My first job, I got the old-fashioned way. I was reading the Sunday Ones ads, and there was a advertisement for a company that was needed a construction engineer on a project, on a bridge project up in central Illinois, about another 2 hours north of where I live, and it required experience with surveying, concrete testing, which I had done a little bit of, and post-tensioning. And I had post-tensioning is something I had studied in college. One of my elective classes, I guess you'd say. And so I said, boy, this sounds good. And I went up there for an interview and basically accepted before they made an offer.
So tell me a little bit about
a big project.
About post-tensioning. What is that and what does it mean?
Post-tensioning is a way to strengthen concrete structures beyond just putting reinforcing steel in them. So you put ducts, hollow ducts within the concrete, and then you later on you put post-tensioning strand in them. It's high capacity, high quality steel wires, steel cables, and then you actually tension those cables. And when those cables are tensioned, they do a number of things to help the performance of the concrete and let you get longer spans. So if you look at almost any of the longer span concrete structures that you'll find out there, it's because they're post-tensioned.
Okay, help me figure this out, because when I think about this in layman's terms, I can envision a 2 foot wide by a 4 foot high by a 20 foot long concrete beam. It's got a hole in the middle of it that I have a steel cable in, but I'm thinking what I could do is I could put a plate on either end of that beam with a hole through it that the steel cable would go through, and somehow it would put some sort of threaded gizmo on there on that cable. Now I'm putting the steel beam into compression.
The concrete beam.
Yes, putting the concrete beam into compression, but this is post-tension. How do you, you got the steel in tension. Is that where that comes from?
So post-tensioning, so it's post, it's installed after. You tension the steel after the concrete's hard.
Got it.
Whereas if you go out there and you see most of your just concrete beam bridges that you see, most of those are what they call pre-stressed. The steel is actually tensioned, and then the concrete poured around it.
Oh, wow.
And then when they release the steel from its temporary anchorages, all of that force transfers into the concrete, right? So it's a similar, it's an extremely similar principle. It's just when you actually do the stressing of the cable versus the pouring of the concrete.
Okay.
And you actually have one in Flagstaff, I know, because it was a job I hoped we would get, and we did not get it.
Oh.
It's a concrete box girder bridge that is over I-40. It's one of the ramps.
Oh, very cool.
It crosses over I-40.
Yeah.
You drive under this boxy-looking concrete structure there above I-40, that's a post-tension box.
Okay. Next time I'm out there, I'll look for that. Very cool. And what was the name of the company?
First company I worked for was Moseman, M-O-S-E-M-A-N, Construction. They were out of Northern California, but they had pursued a couple of these type of projects around the country, and the Central Illinois project was one of them.
Okay. And tell me about the bridge.
It is two parallel bridges, each of them a little over 3,000 feet long, with the main span going over the Illinois River. And it was the first of its type built in Illinois, one of its first of its types built in the country, because it used a number of different types of method to actually build it, to create the structure. And just an incredible learning experience for somebody right out of college, because I got to do so much. And it was not a good project contractually. Our company lost a lot of money on it.
Oops.
They had bid it low, and there were a lot of contractual fights on the job. But 90% of the time, I did not have to worry about that. I just had to help get it built.
Okay.
And so I learned quite a bit through that.
So tell me,
addicted to working in the construction side.
Nice. Tell me a little bit about that, because this is over a half mile long, and there's two of them, like one for traffic going one way and one for traffic the other?
Yes. I think they're now considered part of Interstate 72 system.
Okay.
At the time, the interstate was not yet, you know, in existence, but now it's been absorbed into that. It's just parallel bridges to cross over the Illinois River. Over on the east side of the river, it's mostly farmland. On the west side, and within the floodplain of the Illinois River, and then the west side of the river is over a environmentally sensitive area. I think it's actually some kind of a refuge. By going longer spans, there's less impact upon the ground and on the surroundings.
Okay. And I'm assuming if it's post-tension kind of construction that there would have been piers or some sort of foundations along the way.
Yep.
The sort of things.
Yeah. Most of the spans were in the neighborhood of 220-foot spans.
Wow.
It's about twice what you would do for a normal concrete beam, especially back in those days. Concrete beams now can start getting up to 180 feet, but back then they could not.
Okay.
And then the main span over the river itself, to provide the satisfactory navigation clearance for the barges, is 550-foot span.
Wow. I always think about, how you build these things without having them collapse during construction. And how would you lift a 220-foot span up to put it on its piers, up its foundational, I'm not sure what you call them, the columns that are going to hold this thing up?
There's various methods, and yes, building them without them collapsing is my number one goal. It's evolved in this industry. On that particular one, we did actually build them on the ground, right underneath the span where they would be located. And then we used hydraulic jacks and steel cables and lifted it up using those. It's a massive jacks and massive cable. And we would lift that each one of those spans would have weighed, 25 million pounds? They would have been in the neighborhood of, they would have been more than 1,200 tons. So whatever that calculates into pounds.
A lot,
yes. So then the main span of the river had to be built a different method, because you couldn't block the river by doing that. You would have been too heavy anyway. So a method that's called cast-in-place segmental, where you just build incrementally out from the pier each way, and using a system that's called a form traveler. So it's 16-foot pieces. You just keep adding on each side and just keep doing it till you meet in the middle.
And would you have, like, huge kind of, what would be sort of towers that would, like, send cables out to hold this thing up as it got longer and longer?
No. It was self-supporting while it went.
Oh, wow.
That's the strength of that type of method, is it can do that. But back then, there had probably only been a dozen of those type of bridges built in the U.S. So it was still really, really new technology. It's still not common. There's far more states that have never built a job that way than have.
Okay.
So that was interesting for me from that perspective. And then there's other ways. Sometimes you would build those 200-foot spans on shoring. You would put up temporary shoring and then pour the spans, do all the cable stressing, and then remove the shoring once it's self-supported. another, that's a very common way of doing those type of stands, especially out in California. They make a living doing it.
Okay.
Almost all their bridges are built that way.
Well, I'm thinking of I guess that's called false works.
Yes, because it's exactly what it's called.
And you build that up from the ground, but if you've got a river, it's awfully hard to, how would you do that?
You can't, and that's why you have to find another method.
Okay.
And that's why we did that, yeah, because especially a navigable river, that you're just not allowed to do anything that impedes river traffic.
Okay.
Or you have to say when we're working across, say, the Mississippi or Ohio rivers, where our spans are even bigger, we have to maintain a minimum navigation channel width for the Corps of Engineers. It's usually somewhere between 400 and 500 feet wide, and we have to utilize construction methods that will satisfy that.
I'm just pondering this 550 feet span. That's 275 feet of this concrete box that has to go out that far. How did that thing hold together?
All the post-tensioning. I mean, hundreds of tendons, hundreds of strands, millions upon millions amount of force in those pounds of force in those strands. That's what holds it up.
Wow.
Holds it together.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't understand it, but I'll take your word for it.
Yep. It was very, very interesting.
How long were you on that job?
I was there for almost exactly 2 years.
Okay. One of the things I've learned about the Navajo Bridge, and we'll get there eventually, I learned a little bit about a fellow named Ed Kent.
Yes.
And the world of iron workers who build these things. Who was the superintendent on that job?
On which job?
For this first bridge job you were on.
The gentleman I worked for, his name was Dave Duke, not the politician.
Okay.
We worked together actually a number of times throughout the first 15 years of my career. Basically I worked for him on that job.
Okay. And help me out with just kind of understanding how these projects work. You're working for Mosman. They're out of California.
Mm-hmm.
Were they a subcontractor or were they subcontracting or both?
So on that particular job, it was a confusing one in a way. So the DOT awards the contract, and they awarded the general contract to a company called Schappert Engineering out of northern Illinois. And Schappert subcontracted Mosman to build the superstructure of that bridge. The superstructure was by far the majority of the work on the job.
Okay.
But in order to be a general contractor, you have to have more than 50% of the dollar value of the job. You can't subcontract out more than more than 50%.
Hmm.
So the way that Schappert met that contract requirement is they purchased all the concrete for the job and they supplied it to us as we were building. And by doing that, they were able to exceed 50% of the contract value of the job. We just provided the labor, of course, the staff, the reinforcing steel and the post-tensioning systems and things in the equipment, and so we built the superstructure. Schappert had built the actual piers coming up out of the ground. That was their construction. They provided those to us.
Okay.
Yeah. And so
it just seems like there's an awful.
That's an unusual relationship. In fact, most places won't let you do that anymore. Where to be a general contractor only by supply of the materials.
Hmm. Okay. It just seems like there's a lot of moving parts there, as you mentioned.
There are.
If the and that's Schappert.
I think there's two P's. Schappert.
Thank
Neither
you.
Neither one of those companies is in existence anymore.
Okay. So Schaepert would build the piers, and
right.
and then you guys would look at the engineering of what had to happen there, and then build out, well, you put these beams in place, so that was easy, but then that the big span, the 550-foot span, you had to build out for that.
Yeah, and even the 200-foot span, I wouldn't call them easy. That was only the second time it had been done in the country.
Wow. There
was still a lot of learning curve there.
What kind of things did you learn?
I learned about making a project come together, and that a lot of it is, a lot of it's having the technical knowledge and abilities of how to, how to work with concrete, how to make sure concrete works for you in a lot of ways. I did all the construction surveying on the job. That came from my background. That's why I got the job, actually.
Okay.
For being a field engineer is what they called me at first. And then I learned the field applications of the post-tensioning systems. And so those three things were my focus on that job almost entirely for the first year. And then the second year, I got a bit of a promotion, and then I had to also watch over and manage the temporary works that we were putting in place to support the false work, things like that. And I had I actually ended up with a staff, a small staff, folks, young engineers working for me.
Okay.
And then the other thing I really learned is working with the field crews, right? I spent the majority of my time outside with the carpenter crews, with the laborer crews, with the iron worker crews. So just working with them, helping them out, doing whatever they needed, for that particular project, I would say 50% of what I learned was on the technical side, and then 50% was just how to work with construction workers.
Help me out a little bit with this, because it seems to me, and you mentioned there were some bidding problems.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that if a crew, construction crew, is really working well together, they can speed things along. But if they're not,
then they can make it easy. Yeah, absolutely, that's correct. If they're not working together, they can make it miserable and slow. If they're working together, they can do a good job and make it go fast. But that doesn't have anything to do with the bidding. The bidding is just not understanding the people that bid the work, not understanding it is what they're bidding, not understanding local labor practices, things like that, and making just blatant mistakes. And so you get what you think is a $25 million job, and in reality, it's a $35 million job.
Ooh.
Yeah. So,
how do you keep a business from going bust in that situation?
Well, there's the reason those two companies aren't in business anymore.
Okay.
Some people will say contracting is a four-letter word, risk.
Okay.
And quite often, everybody knows what it is, the work they're pursuing. It's typical to what they've done before. They use historical information, and they bid it, and they don't take all that many gambles. And then every now and then, a company reaches out, tries to progress into a different portion of our industry and doesn't quite understand the work, so the historical information they have isn't applicable. They may not understand the local labor practices, especially if you're working with unions and how unions are involved in the work and how you staff accordingly. And you make mistakes and your company go out of business.
Wow.
Sometimes it's fast and sometimes it's slow. In that particular application, it was slow. It was a number of bad jobs that both of those companies had that eventually took them down.
Okay. All right. So I suppose when you get to the point when you're bidding out multiple millions of dollars, you have a little bit of freeboard, but you can only tolerate so many losses.
Well, so whenever we bid work for a government agency, we have to provide a bid bond. And basically, we have to secure a bond on the job. And that's, you know, a fancy word for an insurance company.
Okay.
And if we default, that company, that bond company, has to then arrange for the completion of the project out of their own money, right?
Ooh.
So that happened. Now, that did not happen on this job. That technically, it hasn't happened on any of my projects. But the that's what would happen if a company defaulted in the middle of the contract. So we just can't absorb these losses anymore. We cannot get any more financing through the banks. We are walking away from the job, or we're closing our company down. Then the DOT, the owner, would then call the bonding company and said, hey, you know, you got a problem here. Your company went out of business. You have the bond. You have to complete the work.
Wow.
And then that company does that, right? And they typically hire another company to come in and finish the work.
Right.
And typically end up paying them a premium to do that. So bonding companies charge, because they're involved with every single bid on every single project, they typically charge 2% of a contract value across the industry, sometimes a little more than that, sometimes a little less. And they pool that money together, and they, for the 1% of jobs that go bad, they use half their money and finish those jobs, and then they put the other half in their investor's pocket.
Right. But again, they're on thin ice, kind of skating along, because if that 1% goes to 2%, they're done.
Right. So they watch very closely catalog of a contractor's work. They in order to get a bond, you have to apply for it to the company. Typically, most of these companies have long relationships with a bonding company.
I see.
They will secure their bonds from that company. In return, that company really watches that company's books and their performance on all their contracts.
Right.
And they will say, well, you've got a number of bad jobs going on. I can't give you a bond because you're at risk of going down. And if you can't get a bond, you can't take the work to the owner. Or they might charge you a premium, whereas normally I would charge you 2%. Now I'm going to charge you 4% because you're a bigger risk.
Right, right.
And they have a number of ways, right? They keep an eye on what's going on. They also look at what a company's assets are. And contractors, their assets is usually their heavy equipment.
Okay.
Sometimes it's some property. Sometimes it's a few other materials that they may own. Historically, primarily their heavy equipment, and to get a bond, you may have to offer up your equipment fleet as security on that bond.
Okay.
So you go out of business, bonding company's going to seize your equipment, and they'll sell it off or whatever, and they'll try to make up some of their losses.
Right, which is pennies on the dollar for those guys typically.
Yeah. So it happens. It happens too often, but.
Some of the risks of the kind of office side that the iron workers probably never see. They have their own risks and.
Yeah. So when you say the iron worker unions don't take any. None of the unions take risks.
Right.
It's just the various contractors.
Right.
So in this particular instance for Navajo Bridge, we hired Trailer Brothers as a subcontractor to do steel erection. And
right. Let's hang on a second before we get there.
Okay.
Because otherwise I'll run over there. I'll get real confused, and we'll have to come back anyway.
All right.
I'm like, wait a minute.
Okay. No problem.
I'm also thinking about Illinois. 2 years. That means winter.
Oh yeah.
What happened at that job over the Illinois River, your first winter? What was that like?
Well, in the old days, and all the old timers would tell me about this. Historically, most jobs shut down.
Oh, wow.
From November through March. And because they could not get a lot of productive work done. With the colder temperatures in the upper Midwest, you have to take extraordinary efforts to keep working. You have to put up temporary structures to hold heat in. You have to blow heat in to keep the concrete warm enough that it doesn't freeze while it's curing.
Okay.
There's all these kinds of extra costs that come about. You just, when you're out there working in 15-degree weather, you're bundled up, you're for the weather, and you're not going to be as efficient working, where normally you might have been able to do something in 8 hours. Maybe now it takes you 12 hours because of the inefficiencies just of working in the cold.
Okay.
So in the old days, companies would just shut down, and the DOTs would not charge them contract time during that time period. That way the DOTs kept their costs down because they're not paying a contractor to take extraordinary winter efforts. And the contractor that doesn't have, they send their workforce home for the winter, and then they bring them back when they're more efficient in the spring and they get on with it.
Right, okay.
What started happening in the 80s is time became a much bigger factor for the DOTs for a number of reasons. But they would have said, well, we want a job done in 2 years. And
instead of 4 or 5?
And so the contractors have to bid it to work throughout the entire year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so then you have to build in those labor inefficiencies. You have to build in the extra protective measures into your bid and whatnot. There's still things in really cold weather where you're not going to be able to work no matter what you do.
Okay.
And the first winter was not that way. The first winter in Illinois was a normal winter. We were able to work, except on the days it would snow. We were able to work throughout the winter.
And so you were still pouring concrete with heaters and probably some sort of, curtains or something to try to keep the heat in.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, we were doing those. We were taking those protective measures and extra measures, and we were all bundling up in 6 layers of clothes, and we were out there working.
Wow, okay.
Then the second winter, the temperatures just got bitterly cold. I was telling you here that we recently were below zero. Well, we had that winter where we had temperatures, our lows were about minus 35.
Wow.
And our high was, say, minus 20.
And oh, wow.
There's nothing you can do, right? So we would just suspend work during those time periods.
Okay.
And then when it was warm enough to resume work, we came back and we didn't get any extra contract time, so it just meant that we had to work harder and faster.
Whoa.
To try to finish the job in the contract time.
That's something that would be mighty hard for an estimator to estimate in.
Exactly. And guess what? They did not.
Oops.
Those kind of things, that's always a gamble for every contractor when you're bidding a job that has a hard date.
Okay.
Is how many days a year I'm going to lose weather.
Yeah.
And you can use historical information, and historical information would have been absolutely sufficient for our first year that I was there.
Okay.
But not sufficient for the second year I was there.
Wow.
It doesn't predict those, those really random weather events. So, yeah, it's a similar job that I've done in the upper Midwest. In January, that the historical information is you're going to lose, say, 10 working days a month every January because of weather influences. In February, very similar. And then to March, you're going to lose 6 days. And then from April through October, you really don't lose many days at all. And sometimes it's only 2 or 3 days a month because of rainstorms or whatnot.
Okay.
So you put those inefficiencies into your bid when you make the bid.
Then I'm thinking about the knock-on effects. If you're going to have to shut a project down for 2 or 3 weeks, the union the union guys, the union laborers, aren't just going to sit around and starve. They're going to want to go off to other jobs.
Now, luckily, when it's minus 35 in an area, it's typically minus 35 in the whole area.
Okay, so
it's not, there is no other work for them to go to.
Go ahead.
But yes, if you suspend work, that is always a risk, is that some of your workforce may leave and not come back.
Right.
And people that you've spent time and effort training and getting them into the rhythms of the project and getting
yep.
to know their strengths and weaknesses, that's all gone when that happens.
Right.
So that is another risk. It does happen. But again, typically if you're having a work shut down due to abnormal reasons, the odds are other companies in the region are facing the exact same thing.
Good point. Everybody's going to shut down, so everybody's out of work, yeah. And that's that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So 2 years, did you take that all the way through to doing the final inspection and walking away and the thing was open to traffic?
Not quite. I got it to where it was what I would call substantially complete.
Okay.
They were still putting the barrier walls in place and getting ready to put a wearing overlay, a temporary overlay on the bridge deck. So there was a little bit of what I would call the pretty work, the completion works to do at the end.
Okay.
But I was tired. It was a rough 2 years. And
how so?
I needed a break. So I turned in my notice. They said, well, you know, work a few more weeks. We'll give you a little bit more money. And I'm like, okay. And then those few weeks got done. And I said, that's it. I'm done. So
how had it been rough? And again, help me with the timeline here for a minute. Let's back up. So you were born in 65, 75, 85.
Yeah.
This would have been 80.
88 through 90.
Okay.
Happening.
And I'm assuming you were working 5-6 days a week?
Oh, at a minimum.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. We normally worked most Saturdays on the job, and typically with what I was doing, you were usually there 12 hours a day, sometimes more.
Okay. And you were salary?
Yeah.
Okay. That's starting to get old really fast. I can see that. Yeah.
So,
and no vacation? I mean, did you get, two
weeks? I got a little bit of vacation, but I didn't take much during that time period, no.
Okay. Yeah, so I can appreciate when, as you mentioned, substantial completion. It's like, okay, I'm done.
Yep, that's it. Y'all are on your own.
and what did you, because you're so focused on this thing day in, day out, week in, week out, what was it like walking away from that job?
Well, I was done with it, and it was nice. I went and enjoyed my summer. It's still maybe my only summer I've had off in my life.
What did you do?
I went and saw friends. I hung out at the local lake. I slept in and worked out and all the good, went to the bar, all the good things.
Okay.
And was doing that for several weeks, and then the company, the president of that company called me up, and he's like, hey, I didn't realize you were quitting. And I'm like, I'm done. You don't need me anymore. And he says, I got another job for you. And I'm like, that's fine, but I don't know that I want to work for you guys anymore. And he talked me into it, and so it was actually 2 months later, I went to work for them again on another job.
And what was that job? Where was it? What was it?
That was a small bridge on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Whoa. So the boss kind of just slides that one in. Oh, we're going to send you to Hawaii here.
Yeah. So they had got that job over a year before, and I knew there were problems on that job too.
Ooh.
One of my co-workers from Illinois had already gone over there and was not happy, and it actually depends upon who you ask. He either got fired or he quit.
Okay.
So I knew there were a lot of problems there. So I went over, and when they mentioned going over there, I said, I need to go over and see the job and talk to the people there before I just accept or decline. So they arranged for me to go over there.
Wait, sorry, I'm going to jump in here. How did you get smart enough to do that? I mean, it takes people a while to figure out, I'm going to go check this out before I jump in.
I don't know. It's just maybe because I knew I had walked into a bad job the first time.
Okay.
And didn't want to do that again.
Okay.
Right away. And that might have been it. You know, I paid 2 years for that lesson.
Okay.
So I went over and met the staff. I knew I had met some of the people there before at company meetings.
Okay.
Was very impressed with them, with the leader of that job, and it was not nearly as technical of a job. It was just a small bridge. It was one that they were having contractual problems with the Hawaii DOT.
Well, define small for me.
This one was a very similar contract value to the previous one, but literally the bridge on that job was 150 feet long and 150 feet wide.
wait, 150 feet wide? That's mighty. Why is it so wide?
Well, it was in a continuation of one of the downtown streets of the city of Hilo.
Oh, wow.
And so it had several lanes going in each direction.
Okay.
Over a small river right there. And it was just, it had to be built in phases is why it took so long with the removal of the existing bridge. I knew that the company that I had been working for was likely going out of business.
Ooh.
Because of a number of bad jobs.
Okay.
And so that was, I actually talked to one of my uncles about it, who was a carpenter foreman.
Huh.
You know, I was going to turn the job down because I knew that they were likely going to go out of business and I didn't want to get stranded in Hawaii. He's like, well, a couple things. One, look at it as a paid vacation in Hawaii.
Okay.
And number two, make sure you get a guarantee of a ticket back and moving costs back if they do go out of work.
Ooh.
So I put those things in writing and I had those things in writing. And so later on when the company did go out of business, I was able to secure passage back and a moving cost back to the state.
What was your uncle's name? He's a pretty smart guy.
Yeah, his name was Buddy Guzewell, G-U-S-E-W-E-L-L-E.
And I didn't ask you, what were the name of your mom and dad?
My mother's Carol. My dad's name was Jerry.
Great.
He passed away some time ago.
I'm sorry. Okay. So it sounds like you had a good team back home giving you some good advice.
Yeah, I would say so.
Nice. So why did this job fail?
Again, it had not been estimated properly.
Okay.
In this particular job, they thought they would be able to convince the owner to build an alternate type structure than the one that was on the plan. And they spent a year trying to get that alternate type structure approved, and the Hawaii DOT just would not approve it. And because of that, the bridge that they ended up having to build, the one that was on the plans, was more costly.
Okay.
And took more time, plus they lost that year while they had been trying to get the other alternate approved. So,
okay.
Yeah.
As a...
Hawaii is a very political state.
I'm not
going to say our company was at fault in this. I think it would have been a better idea and a cheaper idea to build the alternate.
Okay.
But the Hawaii DOT, like I say, it's very political, very, very focused on helping Hawaii contractors out, Hawaii engineers out. And when you have a company from California coming in and telling them, you know, that they're wrong and they should do something different, unless that's approached very sensitive manner, that's just not going to work out well. And it was not.
Right. Okay. So their vision was, we can spread out a lot of money to a lot of contractors, to a lot of engineering, to a lot of construction companies. And you guys came in and said, gosh, you could do it a whole lot cheaper, better like this. But that wasn't the point of the exercise.
Right.
Okay. Whoa.
Very, very spot on.
That's a whole nother facet of engineering and bridge design and stuff that I had never considered.
You do find that throughout the country.
Okay.
Not only there. We find that it's still in, especially some of the smaller markets around the country, there's still a lot of that type of feeling.
Okay. How do you try to figure that out before you go in? I mean, I would assume what you learn is what you're going to build is what they want you to build. Whether you can figure out six ways to do it way cheaper, that's not the exercise. Well, how do you figure that out?
Good question. I don't know.
Huh.
It's understand. I guess a large part of it is understanding your owners.
Huh. Yeah.
Communicating with your owners beforehand. Not leaping in on some of these things without having a backup plan. So.
Okay. So let's go through this then, because I'm assuming that Mosman would have had a bonder.
Yes.
And. So then Mosman would have crashed.
Yep.
And the bonder would have been left holding the bag. How did you hear how that job eventually got completed?
Yes. So the bonding company that was holding the bag hired a local contractor to finish it up.
Okay.
And it was one of the favored sons of that area.
Okay.
And they of course had no problems with the DOT, and they finished it up and got it done, and it was on the plan. I've been back to visit. I've been over it a number of times.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah. Hmm. All right. So how long were you out there working on that job?
I was only there for about 7 months.
Okay. So this takes us up to 1990, 1991?
'91.
All right. Jeff, we've been happily yik-yakking here for a little over an hour. Maybe this would be a good time to put a comma in this oral history series. And let's revisit again in part two. What do you think about that?
That's not a problem at all.
Okay. Before we end this oral history, this part one, is there anything else in the material we've covered that you want to bring in now that you're thinking about it?
No, not that I can think of. You've been pretty thorough, I believe.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part one of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Jeff St. John. Today is Monday, December 26th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Jeff, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom.